Hello, and welcome to Revolutionize Your Love Life. Do you want to know more about love relationships, what makes them work, how to create the one of your best dreams? Do you want to be in a really healthy, juicy love relationship? In these podcasts, we will give ideas and practical advice to light your way. Whether you're looking for a love partner, already in a relationship you wish could be better, or leaving one that has run its course, there will be something to inspire, empower, and support you. Revolutionize Your Love Life is a fortnightly podcast where you will access the knowledge and wisdom of love experts and relationship coaches from across the world to help you find true fulfillment in love. I am your host, Heather Garbutt. Welcome. So I'm here today with a really good friend and colleague who is a psychotherapist with lots of experience. And we've been talking over the past weeks about how issues around dating, difficulties dating, online dating, and particularly around the notion of narcissism and narcissistic relationships and people feeling victim of narcissistic relationships. So this is us shooting the breeze around those issues and talking about the differences between coaching and psychotherapy and what they can inform each other with, for want of a better phrase. So how they can interrelate and inform each other. I'm not naming my colleague because I think it protects the confidentiality of her work with her clients and protects their privacy and the quality of the work. Tell me everything that's coming up for you and your clients around love and dating. See where we go from there.
Okay, cool. So I think there are different types of categories, I suppose. I've got several people who are struggling with the whole social media side of things. And I think that's a whole, you know, that's a societal issue as much as anything else. I think where that falls, where people fall foul of that a little bit is where attachment styles don't suit it. I think you need a pretty secure attachment style for online dating. So yeah, I've got a lot of that rumbling on. I've got, I mean, I would say, you know me, Heather, I would say most of it's down to attachment, however it is that we conceive of that and how deeply we work with it, or how deeply clients are prepared to go there with that and really understand what it is that gets in the way for them around attachment. I think the other societal thing which is running at the moment is a sort of keenness to self-diagnose, or what even worse, to other diagnose. So I've got a lot of people coming in saying, I've got a narcissistic husband. I just keep attracting narcissistic people. And you and I both know that that's a clinical term and not just a social media fabrication. And I think that's a bit of a, yeah, that definitely gets in the way.
It's a big buzz at the moment. It's a huge buzz. Some friends of mine in the Czech Republic who do podcasts around this had something like 9,000 views in 8 hours.
And of course, the really troubling thing about it is that it's a narcissistic thing to do, to point the finger at everybody else. So everybody that's coming in saying, I've got narcissistic mother and I've got narcissistic husband. And I had somebody the other week who was saying, oh, I'm really worried that my son's narcissistic. And it just, not, there isn't an understanding. And I don't even know, Heather, if there should be, really. I mean, does everybody need to know everything about clinical diagnoses? You know, we don't know that about physical stuff. got something
No.
going on physically, you leave it to the oncologist or you leave it to.
Yeah.
I mean, I know Google and stuff has stirred up a lot of things for people around self-diagnosis and, oh my God, I've got pain in my shoulder. What does it mean? What could it be? Or I keep getting headaches. But generally speaking, we're pretty good at going, well, I don't really know. I'm going to see a neurologist. But I think in psychotherapy, there is just this idea that somehow you, oh, I don't know, that you understand things without really understanding them. And that's okay.
Yeah, it's
And it
sort of
isn't.
cod psychology, isn't it? It's not real. Yeah. But it's there.
It is there.
We need to work with it. Because did I send you my article on empaths and narcissists?
No.
Is
this,
is
this... Was it a while? You might have done a while ago. Send it to me again.
I will. Because I think this is an interesting talking point. Where's my articles?
I just find it ironic, really, because there is this lack of understanding about it, that it has become like almost like a narcissistic pursuit in itself to point the finger at everybody else, instead of that
Absolutely.
inner work that needs to be done in terms of, where am I in this? And what is my part in this? And because, of course, we both know there's healthy narcissism.
Yeah.
You know, that's a, we all need it. And it's a bit like, do you remember in the, was it in the late 80s? Yeah, was it in the late 80s when everybody was doing inner child work?
Yeah.
These things become fashionable, don't they? And
They do. And I think where there's an intense charge, it's really powerful. People latch onto it. It's the answer. Yeah. Yeah. One of my headphones has given up. That's better.
Yes, I think you're right. I think it is an idea of, and it's a searching, isn't it? It's a searching for an answer. Because relationships are difficult and you have got to own your own stuff in it and understand it and not pathologize.
So we're talking about projection. So I think we've got quite a lot going on here. We can talk about attachment styles in social media. We can talk about how deeply people want to work with their attachment style. We can talk about projection and the prevalence of the idea of somebody else being narcissistic and what our role is.
And that fits in with othering, doesn't it? Which is very key, certainly in the LGBTQ plus communities.
Wow. So we go, so go on, tell me all about that, because I don't come across much of that. So tell me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just that idea. What we would call it, exactly what you said. We would call it projection, wouldn't we? But the idea that everything bad is out there, and so if we just make it about everybody else, then we don't have to face our own material and or our own racism or our own prejudice or our own discrimination or our own, you know.
So are you talking about LGBTQ people projecting or being projected onto?
Being projected onto, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, the minority group, I suppose. And so just rambling off on another tangent, I've got a guy at the moment who very much feels that as a man, he is othered. I mean, I think it would be unlike...
Yeah.
Not necessarily useful for us to talk about that necessarily, but it's an interesting take.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I think he's right. Because I think feminism has been absolutely fundamentally necessary, but I think we're in danger of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. We're living in our masculine so much of the time, which doesn't do us any good. And we are contemptuous this is broad brush stuff, you know, of men, because they can't do what a woman can do in terms of empathy and understanding and joining the dots. A lot of men can't do that. Largely, they're not wired that way. You know, we've got all the communication bits and all the language bits in ways that men don't in our brains. And that can, it's not everybody, you know, but that can make men feel that they're stupid or that they're inferior or that they are unneeded.
And I think that links into attachment understanding as well, doesn't it? Like most things do, in my opinion, that, you know, it's easy to kind of, again, point the finger at your husband or a man or whatever and say, well, you can't do what I need you to do. But actually, it's a fantasy very often, isn't it? It's a fantasy of kind of wanting to merge with another, wanting to be completely understood, want to be completely seen, want to be completely held, want to be completely understood by. And we need to think, I think, in psychotherapy about the maturational process. And really want to be enabling people to come to a more, to come to a more mature space about what their relational needs are, relationship needs are.
Yeah.
Because there needs to be some sort of individuation at the end of the day, isn't
it? Well, and I think you're right, because I think if we look at it from the calling in the one perspective, and you've got Catherine's ideas of a true love identity and a false love identity. And the false love identity is your child self with unfulfilled needs based on emotional neglect or abuse or absence, you know, trauma of any kind.
Mm.
You get to that. And so if you go into relationship from that place, you're looking essentially for the missing parent. For the missing part of the parent. So you're not going in from a very grown-up place. And I like this idea of the maturation process, so that you know you care for yourself first and then you look for a mutuality in care of other people.
And a reciprocal relationship where you can be both independent and interdependent and dependent. Like we all have dependency needs, and that's absolutely fine. What is less fine is coming from that place all the time, whether we call it child self or false love identity or whatever we call it.
Yeah,
I think
it's all the same
thing, aren't we? So being driven from that place is links us back into what we were just saying about narcissism, because if everything's out there,
mm-hmm.
where is that developmental process that you've gone through
you can't
or
do
haven't
it.
Gone through?
You haven't gone through, no. And it's very much a disempowered place to be coming from.
And again, like you were saying earlier on, I think a place of searching for an unmet need to be met. So if everybody outside you is narcissistic and you are the victim in all of those relationships, then how can you meet somebody in, as you were saying, an empowered, reciprocal kind of place?
Yeah. You can't. And that's the key thing. It's interesting because we're talking very much about the same things. Because if one of the fundamental things in calling in the one is to get out of your victim self, because if you're there, you're disempowered. You can't do anything. You're at the mercy of others. And you're very vulnerable. And so you're likely to get abused one way or another, because you're sort of inviting it, unconsciously inviting it, because you're not treating yourself well. You're imploring somebody else to look after you one way or another. And they can't be your parent, so they end up being uncomfortable with that, and they don't want a relationship with a child, they want a grown up. So even somebody, if you attract somebody who's got secure attachment, if you're living from that sort of vulnerable child place, then they're encouraged to either look after you and baby you, which won't feel good long term, or they get fed up with you and get cross with you, and then you experience that as abuse. I don't think anybody intends it.
Yeah, and we're kind of at risk as well of missing it the other way around as well. So this is it's a kind of mutual problem, really, because whatever it is that the other person brings, they might not, as you just described, want to be in a relationship with a child. But equally, what is it that's going on in that child person that they're the other way around, that they are responding to you as if you were a child or a parent? And that's where I think TA, I often use TA at work, because there has to be an ownership and an embodiment of that integration process, rather than it being projected out all the time, because people may very well feel victims of narcissism. But are those people clinically narcissistic? Are they in therapy for a level of, you know, mental health disorder? Are they, you know, actually struggling with the fact that somebody else has got a different kind of, you know, I mean, that narcissism thing is a personality disorder category. We don't call it that anymore, do we? But you'll be looking at, it's kind of demonized, I think, that narcissistic style. Well, actually, somebody who has a very dependent style, or somebody who has a very avoidant style, or somebody who has even a hysterical style. You know, these things are not being understood in the clinical context that they were designed for. They're being understood, as you were saying, in a cod psychology kind of way, whereby it's not supportive or fashionable to think about how do we support somebody that's been labeled narcissistic by somebody who is very dependent, as if in some way it's only that dependent person that's struggling here. Maybe that dynamic is skewed with anyway, you know.
Well, there's the piece as well as that you touched on then, is how are people attracted to each other? And they're usually attracted to each other because they've got the same sort of core wounds in childhood. It might not be literally the same events, but it could be the same core beliefs that emerge about not being good enough or whatever. And somebody's done some work on it and somebody hasn't. Or somebody's denied it and appears really conscious and confident, but they haven't ever addressed that piece. So they come together and it's sort of almost like divine guidance, you know. No, there's no coincidence. They're pulled together to do their work. And that can go well or it can go wrong. And if they both end up being triggered all the time into their early selves, then you get two kids fighting or two kids helpless. But if you can mutually support each other to come into the adult self, if you both got enough adult about you to go into your adult self with the other person when they're triggered, or not take things personally, be prepared to be curious and understanding and try and get to the bottom of things rather than just dismiss them as narcissistic or pathetic, whichever side of the coin you're on. Because in my view, sort of narcissism in the extreme is probably not going to be something that people want to reflect about. if they are on the narcissist end of the spectrum.
That's why you don't get them in therapy.
Exactly. Because and as well, it's because their wounds are such and the shame that they feel is such that taking responsibility for seeing they've got any part in things is less likely because it's so, so core painful. So they're more likely to be aggressive and defensive. But also at the same time, it's easy to tar men with that brush because they don't have necessarily the communication skills within themselves to know what they're feeling and needing. And they're more likely to just experience stuff in the moment than women are. Women, on the whole, I mean, this is really broad brush stuff, can reflect.
I mean, do we know that from a sort of a research perspective? I don't know if I know that.
It's very broad brush. It's very broad brush. Alison Armstrong talks about it. I don't know if she's done it from observation, empirical observation, but I don't know if it's research. And I think, you know, when we as women are in our masculine selves, we're not being very intuitive and empathic with anybody else. So when I'm in my working professional self, I don't see what's around me. I'm single-minded. And I think that's the thing. It can be, it can move between. How Alison Armstrong puts it is that women can generally speak men's language, but men can't necessarily speak women's language because they don't have the hardwiring nor the cultural imprint to be intuitive, to be encouraged. And I think it's part of evolution because I think men are evolving into being much more sensitive and thoughtful about each other's feelings and women's feelings. You know, it's not all football in the pub anymore. They are supporting each other with their relationships in the conversations. I think, sorry, I'm distracting myself thinking about football, you know. But I think that it's worth really holding this as a possibility because it's part of what gets men tarred with the word narcissist because they're thought to be unempathic. They're not taking responsibility. They're domineering. And these are the cliched narcissistic experience of somebody who is in relationship with them and sees them that way. But it could well be. Go on.
No, I was just going to say, but I suppose they're seeing that through their own attachment lens, aren't they?
Exactly,
and
that's
that. Where this kind of labelling thing is so problematic, and that's definitely what I'm seeing in the clinical work, is that, you know, the label does not help. It doesn't help. It's not about what you're like. It's about how are we together.
And how am I seeing you and why am I seeing you that way?
Absolutely. And what does it remind me of and all of those kind of normal therapy?
Yeah, so if you're looking at it then as an empath and a narcissist in relationship, if we just hold those terms for a minute, if you're an empathic person, you will likely expect the other person to know what you're thinking and feeling without telling them. And if you're not wired that way and you've never been brought up or conditioned that way by society or life experiences, won't have a clue what's going on. Mm. And there's something as well about the way that we communicate, because it's really important that we don't just stay in victim self if we're in the empath bit, that we actually start to speak up our needs, which gives the other person who can't read our mind a chance to do that, to meet them. And if we're always in the victim place, he never, she never, it's really, really a hide into nothing. Mm. So we've got to come back from projecting out onto the other person, how are they like, and think, how am I looking after my feelings and needs? Because if I'm not, how on earth can I communicate them to them, except when I know when they haven't done it?
Mm.
Mm. It was a bit of a big spiel. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's similar language for the same thing. Really. I mean, people can't do that, can they? We know that people can't do that. That's why they come to therapy. Well, that's why all of us go to therapy, that in some way or another, our early childhood wounds get in the way of relating. And that's a search, isn't it, to try and grow into more integrated, into a more integrated space so that we can understand ourselves better.
So in psychotherapy, you're helping people to come to that adult self where they're looking after their feelings and needs by modeling that for them, by you asking what their feelings and needs are and getting them to talk about and listen to them in a way that they weren't listened to.
Yeah, I
So
think it's
you're
the preparation. So that they can have that experience and internalize it. And we all have to do that inner work first, don't we, before we get into relationships. Having said that, we're all different, and how we relate to each other, there's always going to be lumps and bumps in that. So if you've got a very, I was thinking as you were speaking earlier, if you've got a very anxious style, then it's very difficult to not be on that kind of roller coaster of sort of chasing after somebody and then pulling away. That's such a common relationship problem.
It gets triggered so easily. It really does. And then the more clingy you are, the more needy you are, the less likely you'll get your needs met. And that reinforces the anxiety to, please look after me, please love me. But it's painful to watch. It's very painful to watch. Something you said there, I wanted to go back to. So if we just think about defining an anxious attachment style, it's likely to be that you've got a fear of abandonment and being left and not seen and not cared for. So you're likely to pick somebody who looks like they can care for you.
Yeah, and if you're lucky, you find yourself a nice, securely attached person who can do that. And then some of
Exactly.
your attachment needs are met and healed, and if you believe that that's possible, but and if that isn't resolved in some way, or you find yourself attracted to somebody who's more damaged, then you've got a whole different dynamic going on there, which, unless you repair it together and remember you're on the same side and that your partner isn't your enemy, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. And that's really key, because intimate enemies is just such a horrible place to be, where you're in, both of you are in your child self that isn't getting enough and fighting for attention from the other and experiencing the other as withholding. And that's really nasty. If you get somebody who's securely attached, who can look after somebody who's anxiously attached, they can gain security. The anxious person can gain security. I'm not sure it's ever a done deal, though, in
No, I
terms of
don't.
healing.
No. I mean,
No.
we live with our wounds, don't we? That's really
Yeah.
what the whole kind of I was going to say aim, and I don't really mean that in a linear way, but that's the coming to a place of acceptance, coming to a place of peace around how we are, learning that thing about compassion and kindness that you were talking about earlier on.
Yeah, and forgive yourself for getting triggered and be able to tell the other person when you're triggered or tell them when you're not triggered. When I am triggered, this is how I'm likely to be. And what I perceive in that is that when we're most triggered, we think we're absolutely right and the other person is all wrong. And that's just where you came in talking about victim, feeling in the victim role. And that's usually because there's something deep and old being triggered.
And I think coming back to where we were at the beginning about what am I seeing in the consulting room, I mean, this particular piece around relationships and how I am in them, Yeah, I mean that's absolutely key. I mean that's the bread and butter psychotherapy work, really. How do I have a better relationship with myself so that I can have a better relationship with you? And that is, and how do I do that over my lifetime? And how do I have enough insight to know what I'm like and take responsibility for that? So I think, that in a way, we're thinking about what we're doing here, that's a kind of set piece, really, that just what we know happens. And the other stuff around that, like the projection and the societal stuff around narcissism and the quad psychology, I mean, it's a bit of a hobby horse for me, that, because obviously I have a clinical background, but it is something else to be up against in terms of what people bring. And of course we can unpack it and kind of try and get people to reclaim those projections, really. But it is significantly worse in the culture of social media now than it ever was when I first started.
Yes, absolutely.
Didn't even use that language, even though I worked in a personality disorder unit where we definitely did, because it was we had a clinical understanding of what it meant. But this kind of popularization of that sort of psychological language is, I mean, I know what people say. They say, well, it's egalitarian and there shouldn't be any experts, and if you know what you're like and you can read books and do the research and blah 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 blah. But I'm not always I mean, for some people that's great. You can see it on Instagram. There are some people that do, certainly people with a more, we wouldn't call it borderline anymore, do we? What do we call it? Emotionally unstable. Doing some really great self-care, whatever you call them, not podcasts, but
Little reels.
reels, that's it, yeah. About how I manage my feelings when I feel overwhelmed, how, oh, I read this thing about cold water therapy, so I'm not dismissing social media as a terrible thing, but I just think that it's ended up for some people being a tool, a defensive tool that they can use to point the finger.
Point the finger, yes. And I think there was a documentary called The Social Dilemma that looked at this, that it's one of the outcomes of that documentary for me was really that it showed we get adversarial in terms of social media, because we get the echo chamber of having our own prejudices, preferences fed by the algorithms, and it makes for extremism.
And this is exactly what we're seeing. If a bunch of people who feel very persecuted by a narcissistic a decision that whoever it is that they're relating to, mother, partner, whoever, is narcissistic, you're going to bunch that together with a load of other people that think that as well. And so it kind of feeds, it doesn't feed insight. I think that's a thing that frustrates me about it.
No, it feeds tribalism
It,
and
yes.
enmity.
And
What would
also,
you say? Oh, sorry, go on.
as you were talking about earlier on, it feeds the victimness in ourselves. And that's, why is that a good thing? How can that possibly be a good thing?
No, it's the helpless place. You can't change anything from there.
Sorry, what were you going
So,
to say?
well, I was going to ask, what do you think healthy narcissism is, if we were to clarify and define off the top of your head?
Off the top of my head, I would say healthy narcissism is confidence, is self-esteem, is being in your adult, not all the time because we can't be, but having a sense of our worth, of our worth, and also a little bit further up the scale, I suppose, would be something around being performative, you know, having a level of being able to be seen and that feel okay. Having had your bigness really met and matched and understood as a child. So I think it's pretty, you know, it's close, it's required in the same way as dependency needs are required as well. You know, otherwise, how do you be soft with someone?
Absolutely. If you're not secure, if you're not developed narcissistically healthily, you can't be there for another person.
And also, how do you then, you know, without any sense of your own dependency needs, how do you allow yourself to be vulnerable? How do you know when you need to ask for help? How do you know when there's something that's too big for you? So I think the secure attachment idea just has so many different facets to it. And this is where the, you know, that what we were describing earlier on, there's no nuance to that. And there's no nuance to it because it's not understood. And it's not understood because it's not your professional expertise. And it's such an unfashionable thing to say, and I know that. But also, those of us who've worked in that field do know stuff. You wouldn't just get somebody to take your, you know, gallstones out who just sort of vaguely kind of knew about it.
I can hear that sort of offends and hurts you because it's a negation of years of study and knowledge that's not come by easily. You know, it's so self-soul searching as well to really get to the point where you have this level of understanding.
I don't at all have a problem with sharing information. I don't have a problem with social media in its best forms, with empowering people, and you know, information is power, isn't it? We all know that. So absolutely, it has a place for that. But I do think that there is difficulty, as you were saying earlier on, about
it oversimplifies. It just oversimplifies, yes. and it makes it us and them, and it enables people to stay stuck.
I was going to say that it enables people to use that as a defense, and we have to go to that underneath layer as to, gosh, what's going on that means that you really feel that this is going to help you to make this other person the persecutor in this situation? How defended are we when we start to gather superficial information about things, which kind of makes sense, but really on a deeper nuance level are not helpful?
No. And that's when we're triggered and we're seeing and repeating. You know, they get this in the therapy room too. They're seeing and repeating the same old pattern, but they're doing it with a stand-in. So it's not their mother, their father, their brutal grandmother or their unkind teacher. It's this person in the present, and they're living with them and relating to them as if they are those other characters in their life. So the protection comes from overwhelm. So when you're little and that happens and you can't compute it and there's nobody to turn to and you're not held, you make some sort of fundamental decision that this is never going to happen again. I'm never going to feel like this again. So you try and develop protective ways of behaving which don't serve you in adult life. So if I talked about me in hospital, I've got that, I am alone, I'm afraid of abandonment. So how that manifested was that I would cling on to the next person who came, which is any number of different nurses looking after me. And in adulthood relationships, I never knew that I could choose. I just waited for somebody to walk into my sphere and choose me and take whatever they gave me, because that, you know, you take your medicine, that's who they are. You just are with them. And that's the sort of thing that can happen. So it was a protection in terms of clinging on to whoever else would come to me from feeling abandoned, but just taking anybody. And that's quite crazy. I'm trying to think if there's another example that I can give of a protective decision. Maybe you start a new school and you're the one who starts three quarters of the way through the third term and you don't know anybody and you feel that you don't belong. So you behave as if you don't belong. You behave then in adult relationships, not expecting to be accepted, not expecting to be sought out or valued. So you'll probably have relationships with people who don't take care of you, don't look after you, don't consider you, don't really see you, because you'll have made a protective layer of pretending not that nothing matters in order to survive that early time.
And I think if you use psychological language, it's another protection. It doesn't make you make contact with the other person. It doesn't help you to have insight around yourself. It doesn't help you to think about what's my part in this relationship dynamic that we are both in. That the other person is victim to me as much as I am victim to them. Obviously, that's within the realms of a non-abusive relationship, but, you know. So I think that this is where psychological language, particularly when it is not fully understood, is a defense mechanism in itself, of the, in a sense, of the 21st century. You know, let me just intellectualize and talk from my head, and it will completely avoid anything about my heart and what's going on.
Theoretize, and like you said somewhere earlier, other, make the other person other, different, alien, wrong.
We're not in this together. And of course, in a relationship, you absolutely are in it together, unless you're not. And that's, you know, that's, so when people are coming into the consulting room and talking about their relationships, that's what, that's really the first port of call, isn't it? Where are you in this? And I don't know. I think maybe that's just one of the core things about being a human. How do I relate to me, and how do I relate to you?
And how do I relate to life? Because that's the performative bit. How do I become active in the world? How do I get what I need in the world? How do I fulfill my ambitions in the world?
Absolutely. And that makes me think about agency as well. Because there's a nice healthy narcissism, you know. Get out there and be present and be seen.
And give your gifts, whatever gifts you've got.
Absolutely.
Live them.
And of course, actually, I know it. I know this is a hobby horsing and don't really want to go on about it. At the other end of the spectrum, where people are truly struggling with narcissism, or don't realize they're struggling because they're so narcissistic, but, you know, where narcissism is out of kilter, where it is really entrenched, where it's really, where you could diagnose it as a personality disorder. Yeah, that's a whole different ball game from what we were just talking about where are my gifts? How can I be present in the world? How can I be present to you? And that is why it's so frustrating that this label kind of has seeped in, as if that's what we're talking about. And of course, absolutely not. Really, what you and I are talking about now are fairly functional relationships, fairly functional people on a scale of things, not clinically in need of hospitalization or mental health input necessarily in a significant way. We're talking about what the struggle of being human.
The middle of the spectrum rather than the extremes. Oh, thank you very much. This has been great. I think maybe we can shoot the breeze a bit more around this, you know.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to do that whenever.
Okay, this is lovely. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Revolutionize Your Love Life. I'd like to know what has been your biggest takeaway from this conversation. Do take a minute and share this with us and visit us on our Facebook page. You can connect with me personally on my email at heather@heathergarbutt.com. If you can think of someone who will benefit from listening to this podcast, please do share it with them. If you have any feedback on how I can improve it, please do reach out to me, as I'm always keen to learn more. Thank you so much again for listening, and we'll meet again on the next episode of Revolutionize Your Love Life.